Okay, it is...
Volume check?
Now we got... I've got the volume going. It recorded well yesterday. So, it's August 18th. I'm Andrea Meisterwan with Carolyn Bertozzi in our office at the, in the chemistry department at UC Berkeley to conduct the second and final session for Pew Scholars Program in the oral in the Biomedical Sciences Oral History and Archives Project. And... I'd like to start off with the, a couple of questions from yesterday as I had from listening to the tapes this morning. And that was, you had mentioned a high school biology class that you said was important. It really kind of, from that point, after taking this class, that you kind of was interested in biology. And then also in your first year organic chemistry, you had a fabulous teacher. And I just wanted to ask, what made these teachers particularly good about capturing your interest?
The biology teacher, she was just good. Sort of, you know, had a really entertaining lecture style, was funny, you know, and she explained it well. It was an AP biology course, so it was a pretty sophisticated textbook. And, you know, the kids were selected to be pretty motivated kids, you know, so you had a smaller class of... So I think, you know, it was a combination of having the material presented in a really interesting way and having a book that was a challenging book that had a lot of really interesting tidbits in it. I can't really remember because it was a long time ago, right. But it did make an impact, you know, on me. I remember that teacher. You know, she was just one of these teachers that, you know, when... You always got the feeling she was really talking really to you, you know what I mean, and not just sort of lecturing at you kind of aimlessly.
Yeah.
And so that was, she was funny, you know, she had this sense of humor.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you have received quite a few teaching awards.
I don't think the mic was on, sorry. I just turned the mic on. Was it on before?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was anyway. You've been recording. I've been seeing you.
Okay, good. Juggling. So the needle is going.
Yeah.
Sorry, cut you
that's
off.
That's okay. Teaching awards. You've received a few teaching awards across the years. And what do you think makes for a good instructor in science? How do we teach... How should we teach science to undergrads? I'm going to be assuming is where you're.
That's what. Yeah, is. Yeah. I teach. I mean, the awards were primarily for undergraduate teaching. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's people here have different styles, and I know there's been a lot of really innovative curriculum development here, mm-hmm. particularly in our freshman chemistry course. But I've never taught that course.
Okay.
And I cannot claim any credit for any particularly innovative curriculum development.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what... there are certainly a lot of people who have a lot more well-developed philosophies of teaching than I have. That I've never had much of a sort of philosophy in that way. So I think, you know, for me it's more just a matter of kind of getting up there and trying to keep the audience engaged and get them excited and entertain them, you know, for an hour. the awards, you know, I teach, most of the recognition I've gotten is probably for teaching organic chemistry to sophomores, and it's mostly health sciences majors and pre-meds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty big class. I taught this class for about 4 years between like 1996 and 2000, and every time I taught it, there was on the order of maybe 700 students in the class, so it's a
Goodness.
Big class,
yeah.
And none of them are chemistry majors, so we have a separate organic chemistry for the bio majors and pre-meds than we do for the chem majors and chemical engineers, and I taught the sort of health sciences organic chem because that was sort of my interest. And it's a tough class because, you know, none of them are really interested in chemistry, they're taking it because they have to. And most of them are terrified because it has such a horrible reputation as being a weeder course, and as a, you know, if they don't get a good grade, they're never going to get into med school, and that kind of, there's a lot of fear in that course. But it's easy, you know, it's easy for me to get up and get excited about that course because that's the course I took as a sophomore that inspired me to change my major to chemistry. It was that same course. And I started as a bio major. So I felt like I had a pretty good idea of what someone who has an interest in the health sciences would, like, what would appeal to them about organic chemistry and what are the things about organic chemistry that would hold their interest. And so those were the things that I would tend to emphasize when I taught the course. But, you know, it was easy because, you know, every time I taught that course, I sort of had a flashback, you know what I mean? I felt like, oh, yeah, I remember when I first learned this. It was so unbelievably cool and how interesting that was to me. But it's not like I did anything special in that course. I mean, I used the textbook that had been used forever, you know, and I basically generally followed that outline of the textbook and got on the board with my chalk. And, I mean, you know, I didn't really do anything that special. I mean, nowadays, you know, people get up there and they have PowerPoint and animation and there's all these teaching techniques, and I've never been very good at that kind of stuff. Like, I'm much more of a piece of chalk and an eraser on a blackboard, and that's pretty much as I don't get really high tech. Mm. Okay. But I have some demos that I would do in the class, you know. Mm. I used to throw things at the audience. that helped.
Because they were sleeping?
No, just because it was a big class, and, you know, I had a model of a compound. I said, okay, look at how this thing, and nobody could really see it, you know, because they're all way up there, and I'm way down here. So I would say, here, pass it around, and I'd throw it into the audience, and, whoa, you know, they'd start passing this thing around, and I would get three or four of these models going and just toss them into the audience, and I would go up in the, you know, I spend a lot of time up in the aisles when I'm teaching, like, you know, kind of Oprah Winfrey sort of thing, and the students seem to like that, because it's a big class, and, you know, but I think, you know, the reason, more than anything, that I might have been recognized for teaching that course is that they came in with such, like, trepidation and such low expectations, and in the end, they actually discovered it was far more interesting than they thought it might be, and didn't have such a bad time after all. And, in fact, it wasn't such a weeder course, and I wasn't out to get them. And so I think in the end, they were just so thankful that it wasn't the hell experience that they anticipated, that they're like, she's a great teacher, you know what I mean? I think that's part of it, the psychology of that class.
Well, we talked a little bit off tape yesterday about perceptions of undergraduates in terms of what, you know, science expects of them or what a profession in science expects of them, particularly in terms of writing skills. And so there's this perception that those who can write go into the liberal arts and those who can't go into the sciences. And what do you think accounts for that? Especially when, you know, really the medium exchange for scientists are either, you know, verbal presentations at conferences and symposium or, you know, publishing articles.
That's a good question. I mean, I really don't know where the misconception comes from that somehow, you know, people in the humanities write and speak, and people in the sciences, you know, derive equations or something. Mm-hmm. I know what they think we do, but I don't know. But I remember that I thought that way too when I was a kid, and I don't remember why. You know, it might be that when you're a kid in elementary school, there's math and English, basically. Those are sort of the two things that you learn. You learn to read English and grammar and spelling and alphabet and all that, and then you learn to add and subtract and divide and multiply. And, you know, for your first 12 years of life, there's pretty much math and English. There's not much else. And then later, things branch out a bit. So math turns out to be all these different sciences, you know, come from that. And writing and grammar turns out to be like history and social studies and, you know what I mean?
Right.
But that doesn't really happen until you're in like junior high school and high school.
Right.
So there's many years of your life, kind of formative years, when there's really two things. There's reading and arithmetic. And that might just cling to us. You know, so ingrained in our hippocampus or something, so that, you know, no matter what your actual experience is, you can't help somehow feeling that if you're not good at writing, the other thing is math, and math is sort of what you use as a simplification for the sciences. But the truth is, yeah, I mean, and even in college, you know, I don't think that our science courses demanded that much written material from us. At least mine didn't. There were lab reports, but that wasn't really any serious writing. So all the serious writing I did as an undergraduate student was in the context of literature courses, political science courses, history. And I went to a liberal arts college where there was a lot of that. So we had a lot of requirements and you know, 3 literature courses and 2 history courses, and, you know, because Harvard is very much a liberal arts kind of place, and it's not a science-heavy university. Whereas Berkeley, if you're a chemistry major at Berkeley, first of all, take a lot more chemistry courses than were required of me when I was an undergraduate, A. And B, you take a lot fewer humanities courses, and the writing expectation is very low by comparison. So I remember as a college student, every semester, you know, I had to write, like, there are 3 20-page papers and 4 10-page papers. I was always writing papers for courses, and there was just a lot of writing. So every semester I was writing a couple hundred pages in some context. And a Berkeley undergraduate has nothing even close to that. They might every semester write 5 pages or something at the most. And so Berkeley, yeah, you can get away with not having very developed writing skills and graduate and have a degree in chemistry. Probably the same is true for physics and engineering.
Okay, well,
and then what? I don't know. Is people gonna? It's not easy in the world if you don't have good writing skills, no matter what you end up doing.
Right. Well, and there are articles and editorials in the Science and Nature about you know, getting young people interested in the sciences. And if you were to model, you have the example of Berkeley, and to a certain extent, the example of MIT and Harvard. If you were to model a kind of a good education for somebody who wanted to pursue further scientific career options or opportunities, how would you model it?
Well, I think, it was a tremendous advantage for me to have some writing skills. And that didn't really become evident until, you know, I was started writing a lot of papers in graduate school, and then it became even more evident when I was writing grant proposals and so on as a professor. And not that my writing skills are so superior, but they're probably above average, you know, for someone who spent their life as a scientist. But, you know, I have students who have come from small liberal arts colleges. You know, I have graduate students from Bryn Mawr and from you know, Carleton College. I have the student who came from Williams College, who I mentioned yesterday. And in general, these students have excellent writing skills. You know, those liberal arts colleges, you know, have a lot of writing courses and a lot of writing demands. And because the class sizes are so small there, they can assign a lot of writing. So the problem at Berkeley is that how do you assign a 20-page paper to each of the 2,000 freshmen in your English course? You can't grade all that. You know, I mean, you just don't have the manpower to crank out that much paperwork, you know. So the reality of a large institution is that the writing assignments have to be downscaled. And when you're at Bryn Mawr and the course has 5 people in it, those students can do a lot of writing, and you can spend the time really reading what they wrote and giving them a lot of good feedback and so on. So those students, you know, came in here with like a Bryn Mawr student, for example, had no graduate courses as an undergraduate because there are no grad students there. Mm-hmm. And so they came in probably with less of a formal course training in chemistry than I came in with. You know, I was able to take graduate courses when I was an undergrad and get kind of head start, you know, on my graduate work. And my students from Bryn Mawr, Carleton, and so on don't have that benefit. But what they do have is these great writing skills and great presentation skills, and they've had a lot of one-on-one mentorship from their professors. And in the end, I think that really helps them, because I think you can fill in the gaps of missing chemistry courses when you're in graduate school. You're surrounded by 100% chemistry. You know, you're going to fill in those holes pretty easily, but you can't fill in very easily the gap of having, you know, undeveloped writing skills, because you're just not surrounded by people who are going to help you fill that gap in. So if you have to come to Berkeley with any deficiency, although it seems counterintuitive, you might as well come with a deficiency in chemistry, you know, and have, like, good writing skills, because you'll be able to make up that deficiency because your surroundings will support that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, and again, I have a postdoc now who's applying for faculty jobs, and she did her undergraduate work at Bryn Mawr, and then she was a grad student at Yale, and so she's postdoc in my lab, and she's an excellent writer, and she just wrote, you know, an application for the Burroughs Wellcome Foundation. They have this sort of career scholar award or something for sort of postdocs, advanced postdocs, some money that you then take with you as you start your academic job, and it's good money. And, you know, she wrote this brilliant proposal, and I'm just thinking, gosh, you know, I mean, it really is such an asset to her that she can formulate ideas in this way. You know, just excellent the way it's written, and that just puts her way ahead of the pack. you know, and it just distinguishes her, no matter what the ideas even are, just the fact that she can express them the way she does. So, yeah, I mean, it would be great if we could get our students here a little more training in writing, but again, that it's a problem of volume.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do it, you know. You can't certainly have faculty. We don't have enough faculty to teach that many students how to write a really good 20-page paper, you know. We have TAs that can just turn the crank on these things and check them for typos, but that's about it. You know, I don't really feel like I learned to write in a formal setting. No one ever sat down and said, here's how you write. First you do this, and then you do that, and that's the secret of writing. It wasn't like that. It was more, you know, I read enough books that were well-written, and when you read good writing, it helps you learn how to be a good writer. Sorry, to follow that up, like when I have writer's block, mm-hmm. which happens, and I can't get it out, I sometimes go home and read a lot of fiction, like good fiction, well-written stuff, because that helps loosen it up for me. And again, the more I read stuff I think is well-written, it helps me. Not science, just whatever, you know.
Right.
So, you know, maybe the undergraduates could benefit from having more reading assignments where they're reading really well-written stuff, but they should be reading those books with an eye for what makes them so well. Why are they well-written, you know, and really take an analytical view of... Mm-hmm. You know, what's the difference between good writing and bad writing, and how do you incorporate elements of good writing into your own writing?
Yeah.
But it takes practice. I mean, you know, you just have to write a lot of stuff and kind of find your style, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, probably a lot of these people that have underdeveloped writing skills now, you know, if they had a job that forced them to produce a lot of written material, I'm sure they get better pretty quick just by necessity. Which I did, you know. When I go back and look at the papers I wrote as a grad student, I'm embarrassed. They're horrible. The very first paper I ever published, I now go back and read them, thinking, oh my God, what was I thinking? At the time, you know, it seemed okay, you know, but I feel like I've improved things since then.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in terms of mentoring graduate students, I wanted to ask. It seems to me that you were fairly self-educated as a graduate student. That you ended up, you know, writing your dissertation without much direct supervision, at least that's typical for most graduate students. And when you got to the Rosen Lab, you were teaching them as much as they were teaching you, and it was, well, okay. But
they were teaching me a lot.
Okay. And so how do you approach, you know, mentoring your... own students, graduate students, and postdocs to be, balance the need to be self-reliant and teach oneself how to write grants that you did as a graduate student, but also have an active role in their, you know, education?
Well, I have a pretty big group now, and so because of, and I travel a lot, you know, I have for work, and so because of those two things, I don't have as much time as I used to have to interact directly with people. So most nowadays, I think the students who join my lab, they realize that they have to be pretty independent and self-sufficient to do well, because I'm not going to see them every day. I might see them once a week. There might be some weeks I don't see them at all. They can come out. They can come find me. They, you know, the more aggressive they are about finding me, tracking me down, the more time that they'll get from me. But if they don't come find me, I don't have the time to go hunt them down, you know. So having said that, so I think I tend to select a sort of fairly independent group of students all around. And they help each other, and they have their own sort of, you know, little subgroups that are self-educating, you know. So not all the burden of their training is on me, you know. I mean, the more senior students and postdocs pick up a lot of it by necessity. But even still, there are some formal things I do with my students and postdocs on a regular basis. So, for example, we have mini meetings every Friday. So my group has, I have about, you know, between 30 and 35 people in the group. And so I break them down into these groups of six or so, like five groups of six or so. And they come in here every hour, a different subgroup, all day Friday. And they... like maybe half of them will present their data, their recent experiments, things they did over the last week or two. and show their data, and we have an overhead projector here, and we all talk about it, and we hash it out, and I ask them questions, and that's their opportunity to sort of talk about nuts and bolts, problems, experiments that aren't working, get suggestions from the peanut gallery, and just kind of have a discussion. But it's going to be, you know, it's only an hour for all six of them, and maybe only half of them will present each time. So that's one form in which I can get some feedback from the people that are sort of most connected to their research project, other people in the group, and that they get to show me what they've done, and I get to give them my 20 minutes of my undivided attention, you know. But then, like, they talk to me. A lot of them will come in, you know, some of them I'll see several times a week. They'll just come in here, especially at night where it's quieter and I have more time to talk with people. The ones that are more night owls have a better time finding me. So they'll come in and we might sit, hang around for an hour just shooting the breeze or talking about something or bouncing some idea around. They make appointments with me, you know, like I just scheduled for this Monday at 10 o'clock with a student who really wants like an hour of my time where I'm not answering a phone and there aren't a million people coming in. And so like if I tell them, if you really want to talk with me, no problem, just make put it on my calendar. It's an appointment. You come in and I won't talk to anyone else but you. I won't answer my phone and so on. And so there's those kinds of interactions. Those are interactions that deal more with, you know, what's wrong with this experiment, or what direction should we be taking, where should the project be going. Then the other thing I do is for all my second year students, I have them come in and do practice qualifying exams. So a qualifying exam is an oral exam where the student has to defend their research and their general knowledge of chemistry to a committee of four faculty, and they all have to do this in their second year. And so starting now, like we just started this a few weeks ago, they'll come in, and every Sunday, 5 o'clock, 5 p.m., they come in here for several hours. And each week, a different one gets up on the board, and the rest of us sit around the table, and we just grill them. And so that's my chance to really get them trained in the fundamental principles and improve their board skills and how they present their research, how they present themselves as a professional. And I give them advice on you know, just how to take command of the literature of your project. And so when someone asks you a question, how do you respond to it? You respond with saying, well, so-and-so back in 1982 did this experiment published in that journal. You know, that's, you have to show that you know how your research fits into the context of the history of the science and who are the other players and what universities are they at and what have they done and what are the experiments that they do and what are they doing next and how do you fit into that? And so it's an opportunity for me to really train them how to be a scientist and present yourself that way, but under the auspices of a practice qualifying exam. And it's good for me because we do this every single week until they all have finished their qualifying exams, which might happen in April. So it goes from like August to April. And I get pizza and everything. It's like a thing, like a weekly thing. And I ask them questions I don't even know the answer to, and we dig around in books and try and figure it out. And so that's kind of that second year for me with my students that's how I bond with them. They don't know this. They think I'm just helping them practice for their qualifying exam. But what I'm really trying to do is get to really see who they are and how they think and get to know them really well in that context, you know. And I feel like that relationship lasts, you know. And it'd be nice if I could do it in their first year sometime. I don't really start that until the summer before their second year. But it's just I don't have the time really to do that with my first year students. But some of these students, they come right in here and they demand your attention and they really want to talk and I can get to know them really quickly and they really get a lot out of me. Others, they don't want me in their face, they don't want me in their business, they'll talk to me when they're good and ready, you know, and they probably get less out of me, but that's their choice. Maybe they don't want any more, you know. And they can still be successful, of course, you know, it's just a personality thing.
Yeah. Well, and how well then are your experimental skills if you aren't spending as much time in the lab and spending more time?
Well, I haven't been in the lab since, you know, last experiment I did was like in, you know, February of 1996 or something. I mean, I haven't been in the lab in a long time. So I'm of limited utility with respect to daily technical trials and tribulations of research. Yeah. I mean, I'm still useful so organic synthesis is a very mature field of research. It hasn't really changed much since I was in the lab. So because of that, it's easy for me to give good advice when they have a synthetic problem because nothing's changed and I know everything. But biology has changed a lot, actually. The kits that you buy, the way that you clone, like there's all these kits and techniques that these students use now that didn't even exist even 7 or 8 years ago. And so I can't, you know, I just don't have the intuitive feel for those techniques. I haven't done it myself. All I can say is, I don't know, you're going to have to figure that out yourself. I have no idea. Talk to someone else who knows. Yeah. you know, so, and if they really get stuck and I really can't help them, then what we do is we try and figure out, okay, who in the Bay Area knows how to do this, and let's just track them down and call them, and I'll help them find somebody who can help them, but it's not going to be me. So I'm more, you know...
Where is your usefulness?
My role is bigger picture.
Okay.
Yeah, so if they can't get their PCR reaction to work, or if their ligation isn't going, I can't... That's like, they're going to figure that out themselves. You know, that's a detail. That's, you know, that's life. I can't help you. Go figure it out. Try 100 conditions. Talk to people. Be resourceful and so on. But if it's, you know, like, where do we go from here? This system doesn't work the way we thought. Should we even pursue this project anymore? Is it time to bail out and do something else? That's where they need me to give them some feedback. Or just big picture, like, why I think this is interesting, why I think that's not interesting, and how I might see a future for one line of pursuit and I don't see a future for another. And, you know, there's some projects you work on that you can see that they could expand into a lot more projects, and I consider that a divergent, you know, sort of system. And there are other problems you might solve or work on that really converge to an endpoint, and I don't like that myself. That's more of a convergent line of I like projects where I can see what you see there. You know, if you do this experiment or this series of experiments and you discover this, then that's going to spin off into this, and this. And I try and have my students think of it that way. So if you pursue that, you know, if that works, you can see, like, that application. You can try it on that other system and that different organism and so on. And that's, I consider that a really productive project. Whereas if you're trying to solve a problem where when you get the answer, it's over and there's nowhere to go from there, then that's less appealing to me personally. Mm. So that's the kind of advice I give them.
Yeah. Okay.
But they have to be very independent. And, you know, if they, I will let them go out there and dangle from a rope, you know. I can see it. I might say this person's going off a cliff and there's a rope on their neck, and I'll say, this is what I think, you know. But if they feel like, no, I really want to do this, you know, I'm going to let them do it. And, you know, in the end, at some point, hopefully they'll come crawling back up, you know. But that's part of the whole deal, you know. I mean, I certainly went dangling off cliffs when I was a grad student, and that's the only way to really learn.
Yeah. Okay.
But I try not to let them just totally waste their graduate career. You know, at some point I will have, you know, I've had to occasionally sit down and have that really difficult talk where I just say, you know what, you really have to just drop this project now because you only have N years left. This isn't going to get you anywhere. There's something more interesting you could be working on, and here's what it is, and just do this, you know. But most of these students are pretty savvy. They see when things aren't going well, and they look at other students whose things are going well, and some of them will take my advice, some won't. You know, some of them have better ideas than I have, and I'm glad for it, you know. And some of them are, you know, some of them are working on projects that had nothing to do with me. They just had this idea, they wanted to pursue it, they convinced me it was interesting, I found a way to fund it, and off they went. And that's really exciting, because that's, you can see this nugget of talent, you know they're going to be really great. And I've had several like that. I've been really lucky.
Well, is it a matter of luck?
Well, it's Berkeley. We attract really good people. So I think at Berkeley, you're more likely to get these great students, you know, than some other place. So it's not totally luck. I mean, we have a number one ranking, and students know that. Yeah, and I think, you know, they know that they're going to get a certain amount of freedom if they join my lab, and that could be good or bad, depending on how they look at it. But some of them have really made, you know, like, for example, we have a project on tuberculosis. We're studying sulfation pathways in tuberculosis. I didn't know a thing about tuberculosis. And what happened was we were studying sulfation pathways in humans that are involved in inflammation. That had been sort of ticking along. And I had a student come and rotate in the group who asked me one night, well, okay, that's great, but what's known about sulfation in prokaryotes? And I said, well, nothing really. I don't know anything about it, and I haven't seen much. It's just no one's really looked much at those pathways and what role they might play in bacteria. So enter the genome sequencing project. So all these microbes, this is 1999, all these microbes were getting sequenced, and out had popped the tuberculosis genome. It had been sequenced. And the student had taken a gene sequence that we had been working on, was a human gene involved in inflammation, and done a blast analysis, which is a computational analysis of all these microbial genomes to see if there was anything similar, and out popped a whole family of open reading frames from various mycobacteria that were sort of very distant relatives of this human gene. And we're like, well, that's weird. What are these genes doing in mycobacteria? And so the student's like, I really think that we should work on this. I really want to pursue this. I was like, great. But, you know, I was thinking, mycobacteria? I don't even know what that is, you know? So we bought a book, you know, and we were like, okay, who around here works on mycobacteria? We need to talk to some people. And it turns out Lee Riley. Okay. So we went knocking on his door. Hi, we're in the chemistry department, and we found these genes, and we have all these ideas. You know, we think we should figure out what they do and knock them out and everything, but we don't know anything about mycobacteria, and rumor has it you do, and what do you think of that? And so Joseph, my student, convinced one of Lee Riley's postdocs that this might be a really interesting collaboration. And he got those guys on board to help us learn the genetics, like how do you knock out genes in TB, which is not easy. It's much harder than E. coli, for example. And they grow very slowly, and you can't do the same kinds of selections with E. coli. And then knocking out the gene is one thing, but the only way to really analyze a phenotype in a meaningful way in mycobacteria is to infect a mouse and see what happens. And so those guys, you need a special facility for this because TB is a human pathogen and you need to put a spacesuit on and so on. And you need to work with mice in this special facility. It was clear we couldn't do this without Lee or without somebody like Lee. So we just talked Lee into it. And this student was really entrepreneurial because God knows no one in my lab was anywhere close to this. And I didn't know a thing about it. And this student just went out there and just talked to people and pounded the pavement and read things and talked to other faculty and just networked. I mean, he knows everybody. And now he's just starting his fifth year of grad school, and he's sort of famous on this campus. Everyone knows this guy because he's been Mr. Everywhere, you know. And so not only did he knock out these genes and characterize the phenotype in a mouse, which turned out to be really interesting, but he decided he wanted to get the proteins purified and isolated and crystallize them into crystal structures. He wanted to learn mass spec and then probe all their metabolic products and see what was missing when you knock the genes out. And the guy's got like 6 or 7 projects. He's multitasking. He's got a team of undergraduates working with him. He's directing this postdoc in Lee's lab.
Wow.
You know, he spun off projects to 2 new students in my lab and a postdoc in my lab. And we now have, and this is the best thing, he, together with the help of a postdoc, but really he did the bulk of it, he wrote an NIH grant, an R01. And because at the time, this project was spinning out of control, and I was like, I can't support this. It's like mouse costs, and this is, and I was, you know, kind of, I have some unrestricted money from Hughes, but only go so far. And I said to him, you know, we need to get some real money if we're really going to do this, and all these other projects are spinning out of this. And he's like, all right, well, I'll just write an NIH grant. And I was like, okay, you know, but we'll see, but all right, let's give it a go. It's a good experience. And so I gave him some copies of NIH grants. I said, this is kind of how you do it. And we sort of talked about how it could be organized. And then I said, go write a draft and see what happens. So he wrote a draft of this thing and gave it to me, and I kind of fixed it up a bit, but the meat of it was there, you know, and the thing got funded, you know, got a really good score. We brought in Lee as a collaborator, and now we're funding that postdoc in Lee's lab and paying for everything.
Wow.
So, you know, so now, you know, we're publishing papers in tuberculosis, and our lab is getting a little bit of recognition for TB, which is, again, this had nothing to do with me. You know, if it had not been for the student, this wouldn't have been on my radar screen. So this one student comes through your lab, and it's like they leave this trail of stuff behind them, you know, this whole research area. And it's fascinating to me because I've really enjoyed learning about it. And we went to this Keystone meeting on TB this past winter, and I was like, wow, you know, I learned all this stuff about the genetics and the epidemiology and the immunopathology and so on. And so it's given me this whole new dimension in my life, which wouldn't, you know, just because this one student. You know, and every student, I could tell a story like that, maybe not quite as dramatic, but, you know, every student has had their impact, so that when you look at my lab, it's not like, oh, here's Carolyn's lab, and it reflects Carolyn's interests and Carolyn's ideas and Carolyn's... That's just such a minor part of it, you know? I mean, for the first year or two, yeah, that was true. My lab reflected my interests, my ideas. But after that, it just became this conglomerate of all the students and postdocs who've passaged through and made their mark. And so our research program, as it sort of is defined now, is probably as much or more a reflection of the interests of the students and postdocs who've been through the lab than my own personal interests. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, like, if I had different students, if I'd had just different people come through, my lab would look different as a result of that. No question.
Yeah.
So what do I do? It's a good question. I just kind of sit here and direct traffic, sort of, you know.
Okay.
No, I'm the overseer, you know. I mean, I strategize how are we going to get money to pay for all this stuff. So I do a lot of strategizing for how to get grants funded and how to get papers published and how to sell the work that we're doing from different angles and so on, and how to, I go out on the road and I tell the story and I get input from people at different universities and I bring it back here and I file dump it on my students so that we have new ideas for our own projects and so on. So I'm like FedEx, you know what I mean? You know, FedEx just carries things around and is like St. Louis is the hub and everything comes in and then gets sent out again. And that's like what I do. So like information gets dumped into me, and then I kind of pass it out again. And but all the traffic is like my students and postdocs kind of. It's hard to explain it, but that's what's so interesting about labs. You know, it really is like this big city. You know, and there's all these little microcosms, and they all have this little life of their own. You know, and right. and you're just trying to kind of keep it all organized and functional.
Yeah. Well, there are. Anthropologists of science who look at labs as communities and study them like
any other community. They're self-organizing and they also what's the recent popular term? They have emerging properties.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's all this stuff that happens which is more than just the sum of the parts or something. You know?
Yeah.
It's really interesting, isn't it?
Okay. Well, I want to talk more about your research program, your current research program, as it has evolved from, you know, what I had, the material I had available, which is the Pew,
the original Pew application,
and which was more of a direct. I can see the links between your work mm-hmm. as a postdoc and mm-hmm. your Pew application. And
what project did I send in to Pew?
Sulfur transferases.
Oh, yeah, right.
And but
sorry,
you know,
I should know that.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
They did fun.
That's okay. Where you know
so
you're
like
using more language of you know cell biology and things, but you have now you know have won a lot of prestigious awards, MacArthur Award, and extended that area into looking at cell surface proteins and taking an old the Staudinger reaction and tinkering with it, which I was kind of struck by when we were talking about what you did in your dad's basement, kind of tinkering with things and chemistry as a very established field, and yet you're taking it in new directions with your kind of your experience in biology. But I guess to just at least one avenue to open this up is many Pew scholars will have a cell science Nature paper as a graduate student and maybe as a postdoc, and then it takes them a while to achieve that level again and when they're an independent PI. And for you, it seems to be a little bit different. You have had like three science publications in, you know, consecutive years, and so that you, if you use one standard by which we measure success, you know, you have now made it to the top journals and have had several papers in PNAS, you know, a good, solid second-tier journal.
PNAS is second-tier? Oh, damn.
Oh, I think, yeah, sorry.
You know, it's funny, because how you rank these journals really depends on if you're a biologist,
yes,
actually.
Right, right.
If you're a chemist or a physicist, is very different.
Right, right.
Because science for a physicist is like People magazine. I mean,
right,
it's like there's nothing
right,
important
yeah.
in there, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And for a chemist, science... You know, it's nice, but it's not necessarily the most serious journal. You know,
okay, what would be the best?
Well, again, it depends. Science is great because the PR, the press,
right,
you know,
right.
the pizzazz. But there's
yeah.
no detail in a science paper. It's not long enough to have any substantive sort of like experimental information. You can't really criticize a science paper.
Yeah.
You don't have the information.
Right.
So, you know, the Journal of the American Chemical Society is the flagship
yeah,
journal for chemists, where you would publish a paper that is fully elaborated, you know,
yeah.
with all the experimental details, and that has value. So
okay.
that I would say that it's not quite the right comparison. I would say that, you know, a Jack's paper for a chemist has what would have the kind of detail and quality as a Cell paper for a biologist, except it's much harder to get a paper published in Cell
okay,
because
right.
the submission to publication ratio is so high. Whereas JAX, there's fewer submissions and more publications. So it's
yeah.
really not as hard to get a JAX paper as a Cell paper, just statistically.
You're right.
But
okay, yeah,
conceptually,
I see what
it's
yeah.
the same
okay,
kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay, well, when it comes to making decisions about where you're going to publish, why choose science at all as a chemist? And what did it mean to
yeah.
get for you then as a chemist to get an article, you know, report in Science?
You know, okay, so why submit things to Science? Why? So if it's short, if you have a short story to tell that you can fit into an article that's that short, you know, some of my stories I couldn't fit into a science paper if I tried. you know, like War and Peace. You know, you just couldn't condense it into like four single space pages in Science. So it has to be a short story. A, B, if it's kind of impinges on the biological sciences, material sciences, or environmental sciences, then you have a shot at science because that's they want things for a broad readership. So if it's a story that's really a very chemical story that only chemists would really appreciate, chances are science won't be interested in it. They want something that has broader appeal. So you have to have a sense of how broad is the appeal or the importance of what you've done, which is very subjective. But, you know, you go to science, obviously, to get the readership and the PR, you know, yeah. There's just, you know what I mean? There's a lot more people read science than read Jax.
Yeah, okay.
You know. So the impact factor, I have no value with it, which
right.
I hate. Yeah. But of all the papers, I have to tell you, of all the papers from my group that I've sort of taken pride in, you know, mm-hmm. with respect to our accomplishment as reflected in that paper, it's not actually any of our science papers.
Okay.
I would have to say, like, you know, the one paper that I'm most proud of, because I think of it as a really important discovery, an important achievement, a heroic experimental effort, that took such a combination of skills that very few students could have pulled it off was this one, actually, which I'm just fixing up for JBC.
Okay.
Now JBC is considered right. a journal with it's a huge journal with, you know, hundreds of thousands of pages every year and a lot of really long,
right.
gory articles that are too hard for anyone to read. And, you know, it's not considered a journal that you skim through on the airplane, right? It's a journal that you pick up papers as they come up in your SciFinder searches and so on. Right, and so JBC is a well-respected journal, but it's definitely a kind of a nuts and bolts. It's not considered a flashy, you know,
right,
high-profile,
right.
make-you-famous kind of journal.
Yeah.
And yet, to be honest, I think that this paper has will have more impact long-term. It's a more fundamentally important discovery than the snazzy stuff I've published in Science. Science is in chemistry, science is really for snazzy stuff.
Okay.
You know, it sort of has a kind of sex appeal,
right.
and it's kind of flashy, and it's
sex
something
science.
Kind of cool that might be really important, but maybe not. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe it's just kind of cool. And so, you know, I think, yeah, we've published papers in Science, and we did that. You know, I've sent things to Science because I thought that the biological community mm-hmm. could really take advantage of this chemical tool. So we had a tool, and we thought this could really help a biologist and do things that they couldn't do any other way.
Right.
We should try and get this into Science because they'll see it. That's when I would go to Science. But if it's like, you know, this is a paper that we could hardly even fit it in these 12 journal pages. I mean, just to really explain the story in all of its glory. And it really is just an unbelievably interesting story. But it's a glycobiology story that you probably wouldn't care about unless you're like a glycobiologist, you know.
Right.
So it doesn't really belong in Science.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell us about this heroic story? Because I didn't.
It hasn't
been published yet.
It's the galley.
So let me flip the tape over before we.